charging your receiver before the IF strip gets ringing like a bell because the pulse is so loud, and you don't want to wait until your IF strip stops ringing. You wouldn't live long enough. I'm exaggerating. But you want the hit to your electronics to disappear in a fraction of a microsecond if you can, and you don't want it to be persisting for milliseconds. Otherwise, you've got an awful lot of noise out of the loudspeaker, out of the earphones. It's hard to tolerate. So when these radars are operating, if you use the right kind of electronics to tolerate it, we can be thoroughly compatible. So even though they're in our band, it doesn't bother me. Maybe that helps a little bit. Back to you, Mel, for any further comments on the HULIW and the TechNet.
Very good. Dick, the OTH, like you say, radar that Russia was experimenting, driving everybody nuts with the Woodpecker, did they give up on that? Because I haven't heard that in years, over.
I think they did. I think the experiment was over. The Soviet Union no longer is, they call it the former Soviet Union, and so on. So I think that's no longer being maintained. I don't think whatever data they were getting out of it is no longer, I don't think it's valuable any longer. So to my knowledge, that thing is gone. Now, I'm listening on the input to this repeater as well as the output, and I'm hearing a signal, very weak, coming through my receiver, but it is not coming through the repeater. I hear a KB2 something. Will that person want to try again right now? Go ahead. The KB2 station, give it one more try. Okay, I'm hearing KB2URZ on the input and just barely coming through the machine. I don't know if we're going to make it with you, sir, but I have one other man ahead of you that I've got to handle in our list. Two guys ahead of you, Bob and Barry. So we're going to try to get back to you. KB1OQD. KB1OQD. Bob, go right ahead with your question. K2IW in the TechNet.
KB1OQD. Good afternoon or evening, Dick, and everyone on the net. Yeah, the question is, I'm looking to get a radio soon there. I'm looking to go two ways, a mobile and an HT. I was just questioning on an HT there, capability that it has on 5 watts, using it on a base or mobile antenna, how good would it really be able to put out? Because what I'm looking for is an emergency radio too, also when I can't go mobile, you know, loss of power or anything.
Yeah, glad you asked that question, Bob, because this is something that you will not read clearly defined in any of the spec sheets for any handy-talkie. And the best example I can think of this is in Space Shuttle number 65, I think it was, with astronaut Owen Garriott on board. This was 1985. I'm one of the few people on Long Island who talked to astronaut Owen Garriott. When he was doing his passes from Connecticut toward, Texas toward Long Island, he operated his Motorola handy-talkie into a taped-on antenna on the observation window of the crew quarters of the space shuttle, with the space shuttle upside down so that that window was aimed directly at Earth. As he went any further north than northern Texas, I had no trouble hearing him with a simple 5/8 wave whip antenna on my automobile in the parking lot of Airborne Instruments Laboratory. So I'm hearing him, and I start shouting back to him. And of course, he doesn't respond. And this went on day after day. Finally, I decided to stay home one day when I knew a shuttle pass was going to happen. And I'm aiming up 350 watts of power with a 14-element Yagi directly at him. And when I listened to that tape recording of my voice coming through his handy-talkie on the space shuttle, I can barely hear me climbing above the rabble of all the other signals trying to get through at the exact same time. And what I realized is that a handy-talkie is a very compact rig that's carefully designed to be low on battery drain so it doesn't kill the battery in half an hour. I'd like to be able to listen with the rig for 12, 14, 18 hours before the battery goes dead. Well, when you make a rig draw low current, it has, by definition, low intercept points, low dynamic range. In other words, it does not properly tolerate strong signals. So you take your handy-talkie to the top of the Empire State Building, to the observation deck. You hold it in your hand. You try to hold a QSO with your buddy in Huntington. The buddy in Huntington will hear you like gangbusters. The guy in Huntington, if he doesn't have a moon bounce rated rig, he's not going to get back to you because you're alongside of a whole lot of potent transmitters on top of that Empire State Building, and that poor handy talkie is going to jump out of your hand and say, I give up. It doesn't have the front end tuning, it doesn't have the filtering, it doesn't have the intercept point. In order to have intercept points, your stages of the receiver have to be biased at a high current level that gives them the ability to tolerate strong signals. When you make a high current biasing on the transistors of your handy-talkie receiver, it's going to kill the battery. So you're between a rock and a hard place. If this is the best of all worlds, you would have a great big switch on the back of your handy-talkie. One switch is battery saver mode, which is the mode you've got right now. And the other mode would be high dynamic range, where it draws a hell of a lot more current and now can tolerate strong signals. But even that wouldn't solve the problem because it doesn't have enough filtering. A well-chosen base station rig has a hell of a lot more filtering in the front end. They're not worrying about using minuscule amounts of power. They're worrying about high dynamic range. I'm using a Kenwood TS711A right now. It's one of the fairly high dynamic range rigs. The Yaesu BC221, I think it was, something like that was the model number, had a trackable tuning front end to the thing. Man, that thing was a real potent receiver that was very hard to overload by strong adjacent frequency signals. So when it comes to strong signal overload, base stations are far and above ahead of handy talkies. So a handy talkie connected to a good base station antenna, if you're living in Montana, would work like a charm. If you're living in New York City, you're going to get more intermods than you're going to get signals. So to try to use a handy talkie simultaneous application as you would a good base station or a good mobile rig. Now, mobile rigs are somewhere halfway in between. Good mobile rigs, nowadays, everybody wants them to be super compact. Does that give them enough room inside to give a good filter in the front end? Or do you have to add external filters to make sure that strong local signals don't give you problems when you're in the heat of battle, if you know what I mean? So if you're worried about having high reliability in strong signal environments, you've got to be kind of careful in how you choose the rig. And so I've given you some of my opinions, some of the things you've got to worry about a little bit, Bob. And maybe there are other people with other opinions on this. So drag your feet a little bit. KB1OQD with a little bit of delay. KGYW in the TechNet. Looks like no one else got opinion on it. You got it, Bob.
Okay, Dick. That answers the question there. Yeah, I'm trying to go budget-wise anyway, you know, as far as that, too. I got a old Yaesu here, FT107M, and I'm trying to find the other part that goes with it that has 2 meter 440, but unsuccessfully able to locate it to have a good base unit there. That's why I'm looking, you know, for kind of the best of both worlds, I guess, you know. Gonna have to find a decent mobile to go base there. And I think that's about it as far as questions there. I know there's other people out there and the other half waiting upstairs for me, so I want to thank you for everything there, and everybody on the net there, appreciate you. Let me on there, and hopefully soon I'll be up there talking there. And like I said, right now I'm only listening to everybody out on the other side of the pond there. But I want to thank you and everybody else again. 73s, and we're going to sign here with KQRIW, KB1OQD, 73s, and good evening.
Very fine, Bob. Good luck with your search for the ideal rig that does everything. When you find that ideal rig that does everything, please come back and tell us what you discovered, because it's a difficult one. You're between a rock and a hard place to get all of those solutions simultaneously. Barry, what's going on with the microwave voice of Far Rockaway? N2, Moonbound, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, before I go on, are you hearing me okay now?
It sounds beautiful. Please proceed. Nice voice, nice audio.
Okay, real good. Yeah, I've got, as you know, I have a full-size dipole, vertically polarized right now, kind of V'd, and I'm using that as one element of an antenna. I haven't put the second element up, but I do have a horizontally polarized inverted V about 50 feet or so away from it. And it's what I wanted to do was the vertical dipole, I'm using open wire line to that at the moment, and that's going to my radio. I wanted to try to play around with the phasing of the other dipole, the other inverted V. I'm not sure how to do that. One idea I was thinking of from a long time ago, and I want to know if this will work. I was going to, it has coax coming off, but I want to bring it down to an antenna tuner and put the antenna tuner into a dummy load, 50 ohm load, and by very carefully adjusting the antenna tuner, can I affect the...
Barry, your signal suddenly stopped.
Back on with another radio. That was just close. I have no idea what. Anyway, did you get the gist of that? And in the meantime, let's try to find out where my radio is going.
Okay, the audio on that one is very, very low, but we're hearing you. And you got some good RF. I think I see what you want to do. You want to adjust the antenna tuner into a dummy load. And yes, the antenna tuner allows you to impedance match. And you would like to use the antenna tuner as a phase shifter. And if you're willing to forego the impedance match and sacrifice some of the power that goes to the dipole that's being fed by the antenna tuner, you can affect some phase shifting. My gut feel is you can get plus or minus 30 degrees of phase shifting by that means before the impedance matching goes haywire. But to simultaneously get impedance matching and phase shifting out of an antenna tuner is asking for too much out of too little. And to really steer the beam until you find out either mathematically calculated or actually do some measurements, it would be nice to be able to shift plus or minus 180 degrees continuously, slowly crank in 180 degrees positive and then 180 degrees negative and see what happens with your phased array. But since you're combining a vertically polarized quasi-inverted V with a horizontally polarized inverted V, the results are going to be interesting. Will you be able to steer the beam in the conventional manner? Or will you be able to steer a null in a certain direction? Let me think about that. I think the answer is yes, but it's a more complicated case. The fact that they're cross-polarized and displaced and being phase shifted, without a doubt it's a phased array, and you will be able to do electronic steering. My gut feel is you will not be able to steer a deep null into all directions. You will definitely be able to steer a deep null into some directions, but the null that you steer into some directions will be slightly dependent on the state of the ionosphere and Faraday rotation today. Because you're cross-polarized in what you're emitting, and because of the way the non-reciprocity of the ionosphere with Faraday rotation, in other words, the ionosphere is a plasma. It's a conducting medium. And when you mix a conducting medium with a magnetic field, and you send a radio signal to it, a horizontally polarized signal may come out vertical after being twisted full 360 degrees twice. And how much it gets twisted is a function of 1 over frequency squared. The lower the frequency, the more the twist capability of the ionosphere. So when you steer a deep null because you've got a jamming signal in London and you want to listen to that weak signal in Holland, and you steer a deep null on London, and you adjust your equipment to give that null today, and you got ionospheric reflection going on. Stand by a second. Will that null require the exact same tuning tomorrow? And I think the answer is maybe no. But still, it would be a fascinating experiment. I recommend you go do it. And your next question is going to be, what do you do to get a phase shifter? Well, by putting in chunks of cable by way of relays, you can put in 10 degrees, 20 degrees, 30 degrees, 50 degrees, 100 degrees, and so on, of cable. You switch in the cable and then do your fine-tuning with the antenna tuner. That will do it. I think your antenna tuner will give you the ability to get something like plus or minus 30 degrees. But that's a guess. But I think you can do that. So that the antenna tuner can be the fine-tuner. Throwing in chunks of cable with relays can be the coarse tuner. And now you're doing this on one antenna versus the other, and you're combining the signal between the two antennas. And to get a deep null, you got to do two things. You got to shift the phase of one versus the other, and in most cases, you got to adjust the amplitude a little bit in one versus the other. I think your antenna tuner, by way of intentionally detuning, I think it can do some amplitude control. I'd have to think about that now. Where's the amplitude control going to come from? They'd like to be able to move one antenna versus the other up and down by 20 dB in continuous fine steps. That's what you'd like. Complete phase shifting of phased array control requires amplitude control and phase control. Once you've got that, and you've got a number of elements where you can do this on, boy, you can electronically steer that beam in space in microseconds. You can move from point A to point B. You can steer nulls on strong guys you don't want to listen to. You can steer a peak on the weak guy you do want to listen to. You can do the compromise between the two and get the highest possible signal-to-jammer ratio and so on, signal-to-QR-Mary ratio. So phased array is definitely the way of the future, but it ain't simple. As you and Mel and other guys are finding out who delve into this, there's a fair amount of complication here. But just like learning computers, in the beginning, if you suddenly woke up right now like Rip Van Winkle and somebody, you know who I'm trying to say, and you suddenly look at a modern-day computer, you'd say, no way in hell am I ever going to learn that. Well, you've lived through it, and you slowly learned all the steps, and most of what you want you can get out of those machines. So step by step, by divide and conquer, you study phased arrays, guaranteeing the investment is not going to be a waste of time. N2 Moon Bounce, K2RIW and TechNet.
K2KEY with comments.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel, first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. There's seldom a night when I'm on 75 meters, 5 days a week. Barry knows, he's joined me and my friends a number of times. There's seldom a night goes by that I don't have a difference in the way the signal is coming in from my friend in Pennsylvania. He may start out many times that I see the signal nice and strong, and I say, oh, the signal, like I say, if I adjust the loop horizontal, that's going to peak his signal. As the night wears on, we usually get on and we can yak for at least an hour or more. The signal many times is going through somewhat quick vertically. Then it's going again backwards. It never seems to stand still for any long period of time. In other words, there's no such thing that I don't make adjustments on the in-receiving loop at least two or three times during the average night QSO. Some nights it's even worse. I can't keep up with it. It drives me crazy. I'm constantly adjusting there to bring him, peak him back up. Now, with my regular one-wavelength transmitting loop or transmitting receiving loop, the one outside, I had told you originally, you know, when I originally had it set up so that I could, on the antenna tuner, if I rocked the antenna tuner to the point where I had the minimum SWR, some stations would tell me that the signal was weaker. As I swung it through, supposedly, to basically get a higher current than one of the two wire feeders there, like I say, it was 600 ohm open wire feeders. As I increased the current in one feeder over the other, some stations told me I was stronger. As I went the other way to the other feeder, other times another station would tell me I'm stronger, the other station would tell me I'm weaker. So something, like I say, some kind of change is taking place right there just by manipulating the antenna tuner and adjusting. At the point where I had the lowest SWR, you would think that overall everybody would say, oh, that's the strongest signal. No way. At the lowest point of the SWR, usually everybody agreed that, wherever it happened to be, that the signal was not as strong, Dick. A lot of experimenting to, you know, go through, but it just shows you that there is some kind of phasing that is going on, even just on a simple, straightforward loop antenna with a balanced input to a tuner over.
Yeah, as I see it, Mel and Barry, that's a strong chunk of indication that the ionosphere is giving you a lot of twist due to Faraday rotation. And the ionosphere is itself always moving because it's the result of the past solar radiation of that particular portion of the Earth. So as you go from a high noon toward the terminator toward the midnight, all kinds of changes are happening in the ionosphere's altitude, thickness, intensity, and the Earth's magnetic field is always moving depending on what the rate of charged particles coming out of the sun. The solar wind hitting the Earth is continuously moving the Earth's magnetic field. So everything's in motion, and with multiple twists of that signal before it gets between Pennsylvania and you, that's what I think you're seeing. So I believe you can have a lot of fun with this one, Barry. finding the right way to get amplitude adjustment and phase adjustment, it's going to be a little bit troublesome. I think it's worth the investment, because I think you're going to have a lot of fun with this thing when you go forward with it. N2 Moonbound, KQLIW. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, I got one other idea. Instead of putting it into a dummy load, I have another approach that maybe make it a little easier for myself. How about I bring both antennas down to a T-connector? So I've got them both coming together, but one antenna, I have this antenna tuner in line, just so that I could change the phase to that antenna, electronically try to shift the phase a little bit. What do you think of that approach?
Yeah, that's getting back to what I was saying earlier, Barry. However you get the signal to the two antennas, one of them you're going to be shifting amplitude, and it doesn't matter if it's the same one or the other one, you're shifting amplitude, and one of them you're shifting phase, or both of them, amplitude and phase going to the same antenna. It doesn't matter too much how you do that. However, it is my belief that the antenna tuner is only going to be a fine tuner. I think you're going to have trouble getting beyond plus or minus 30 degrees of phase shift with your antenna tuner. You'd like plus or minus 180, and 30 degrees is only one-fifth of the way there or something like that. So you're going to need a coarse tuner on top of the fine tuner. Your antenna tuner is the fine tuner. Throwing in lengths of coax cable that are a quarter wave long, a half wave long, three-quarters of a wave long, and so on, by way of relays, is going to give you the coarse tuning. And you're throwing in those lengths of coax cable into one antenna with reference to the other. In other words, if you do take your transmitter into a T-connector, which is a poor man's power divider, and from the power divider, one cable goes straight to antenna number one, the other signal goes from power divider through your coarse tuner, where you can throw in lengths of cable that add and subtract coarsely, and then through the antenna tuner, and then into the second antenna. And now you can really do the experiments in phase shifting. But the antenna tuner itself, unless it's a very exotically designed antenna tuner, is not going to give you enough phase shift, in my opinion, Barry. N2MB, KQLIW.
Okay, you think maybe I would get 25 or 30 degrees of phase shift. That's really quite a bit. All right, I got it. It sounds like I'm going to have to go to Plan A, which I really, you know, I didn't want to do yet, but I think I'm going to have to do it, which is what you just said, a real fancy phasing system, and will affect the length of the coax of the antenna. That was my original plan, you know that, and I guess maybe I'll just revisit that one. I was thinking maybe I could just, you know, from an experimental point of view, before I went and did this whole phasing thing, maybe I could just tweak it and play with it, you know, and see what we were getting. There's another device made by MFJ, which does something electronically, shifts phase. Might be used for receiving to try to play with the two antennas. What do you think of that one?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of mixer-like devices that will give you automatic, I mean, variable phase shift and lots of degrees of it. And to do it at receiver power levels is easy. To do it at transmitter power levels is very difficult. You know what a parallel kilowatt amplifier, strip line amplifier looks like, and you know what that flapper capacitor looks like. I have on paper, in my mind, on a couple of occasions, sketched out a piece of strip line which is kind of a U-shape inside of a box, just like the parallel kilowatt. And there's two separate flapper capacitors, and I forget what else I had in there. And by arranging things just right and flipping those variable capacitors, flapper capacitors, moving them in the right ratio between the two, I thought I could make a pretty wide phase shifter out of that. And so, and if you could succeed in doing that with strip line in a similar construction to the parallel kilowatt amplifier, it would be kilowatt rated. And if you could do it on the transmitter and doing it and using it on both transmitter and receiver, would be a fun thing to do.
Yeah, you were doing this on microwave. Makes it much easier.
Yep, you're right. You got it absolutely right, Barry. It's a good thing I'm listening. In other words, to try to do that on 80 meters is out of the question with strip line. Not out of the question, but boy, would it be difficult. On 80 meters, there's got to be ways of making a variable inductor, variable capacitor combination, roll inductor or whatever, to do phase shift. There's got to be a way of doing it. I haven't seen the details yet. I own a couple of books on phased arrays and phase shifters. Unfortunately, every one of those articles is oriented toward upper UHF and lower SHF, microwave type stuff. Very few people do gross phase shifting with fine variable capability, fine tuning, course tuning. Very few people do that at HF. I know it's doable. I just don't know how to do it the best way yet. And the best I can think of is this course fine tuner you and I just discussed. But I think we should investigate it more, because I guarantee as we dig into it, like every other synthesis problem, there's an infinite number of solutions, and there's got to be a better way. Because as you get lower and lower in frequency, usually things get easier. So somehow we're making this one too hard. And at the current rate, Barry, question number one is, when do you think you'd be putting up more elements of the antenna? And maybe you're delaying it until you do this phase shifting experiment between the horizontal and the vertical. Second of all, you seem to be back on the transmitter that stopped operating. What was it that made it stop? Back to you, Barry.
Okay, yeah, the reason the transmitter stopped working was the infamous fuse connector to the 910H. They have this stupid-looking wire with two little clamps over the fuse and a plastic holder. Notorious problem. All I did was pull the wire, shake the wire a little bit, clean the connection, and it's working again, so I'm going to probably have to address that pretty soon. I'm not all that interested in the phase on transmit. Mostly on receive, but what I can gain on transmit is a dB, maybe 2 dB. Maybe 2 dB if I could do this on transmit. It's hardly worth the battle on 75 meters to get 2 dB. But to be able to receive much better and get rid of the noise, that's a big deal. So I think I'm going to go back to this with the electronic phasing thing made by MFJ. The only problem is that I now have a 1,000-watt amplifier, and that MFJ cannot take that power. So, but I will look into it. I think I'm going to play with that before I go ahead and finish the phasing system for the next element. I was planning on doing the next element within the month. I have been calling Comtech. I don't know if he's on vacation or what, but I haven't reached him. He was going to make up some kind of a phasing harness thing. Not a phasing harness, but a little transformer, you know, to get the impedances back and everything else, with a fancy switch that was remote controlled, so wouldn't have to have it all come in the house. He hadn't done that. So in the meantime, I'm going to look into just what I can do to do it electronically on receive, and I think I might get some good answers with that. That's the main reason I'm doing this anyway.
Boy, have I got the solution for you. I just thought of it. Since you only want to do it on receive, since you want to do it electronically, build what looks like a preamplifier into each cable coming from antenna A and antenna B. Each goes into preamplifier A and preamplifier B. Then get some together in some kind of a simple resistor divider network, summer power divider network, and made out of resistors, and then it goes into the receiver front end. The electronics of the so-called preamplifier is going to be an op amp. If you take a look at my third generation book by Burr Brown and Op Amp Techniques, there's a beautiful circuit in there that as you turn a potentiometer on this simple op amp circuit, it has zero change in amplitude and at least 0 to 180 degrees in phase, and it might be 0 to 360. I'm going to double check that. And if it's only 0 to 180, you put two op amps alongside of each other for 50 cents a piece. There are operational amplifiers these days that work very well beyond 100 megacycles. So to use an op amp at 3.5 megs or 7 megs, and to use it in one of these simple resistor circuits, RC circuits, where as you change the potentiometer, the phase shifts either 0 to 180 or 0 to 360. You've got all the variables you want in this very simple op-amp circuit for receiving. And there's another op-amp circuit you can easily build that can make the amplitude go from plus 20 to minus 20 dB. Plus 20 to minus 20 dB by twisting one single op-amp, one single potentiometer. So with the op-amp, and you've got two identical preamps going into the two cables from the two antennas into the power summer, into the receiver. Now you've got all the adjustment in the world. In fact, there's a way to get 360 degrees if the op-amp circuit's only good for 180. Use preamp A 0 to 180. Use preamp B connected to antenna B 0 to 180. Between the two antennas, you've got 0 to 360. and then you can adjust the amplitudes, any combination you want. Op amps are your answer, Barry. Tiny little circuit, simple little knob with a simple potentiometer, complete continuous control of every single degree of amplitude, of phase, and every single fraction of a dB of amplitude. You want op amps, Barry. That's the answer. N2MB, K2LIW.
K2K, Y comment.
Okay, Mel. I will never step on you, Mel. Okay, it just turns out that Richie Tash loaned me a device called a noise-canceling signal enhancer. I think that's the one. And it has a phase control. It's doing exactly what you said. It's got the op amps in it. I can adjust the amplitude. I can adjust the phase. The whole schmear-gots. And I don't even have to make it. I'm holding it in my hand. I was supposed to bring it back to Richie. I never did that. It's called an MFJ model 1026. And I am going to try that tonight. Because I think that's the answer. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, well, you know, on the receiving loops, I got the two receiving loops. And basically, what I'm doing is taking each one of the loops, and it goes into a FET front end, each one. That is fed then into a transformer, which is a trifiler wound on a toroid. And with that, I have a control. Now, I have one control for phasing, which I can, in other words, phase between the two antennas to get the optimum low noise. I also, at the same time, have an RF gain control, which then presents that to a Q multiplier. Now, with the Q multiplier, I can get terrific high dynamic separation of the signal and noise. Oh, I get at least 100 dBm. And a voltage gain, if I need it, because you will lose some signal level, you know, with the loops and the processing, you lose some signal. So I can get a 10 volt dB gain of also a volt gain to present to the receiver by using the Q multiplier. So I found that's the best way to go. I bring the signals in, I process them, put them through a phase circuit, and then process them again through the Q multiplier. And by manipulating all these things, including the loops, the variables on the loops, peaking back and forth, I got a switch for reversing the system, and all, you can get terrific separation of signal to noise. In fact, I get noise levels here all the time, not unusual, 20 over 9, 25 over 9. After I go through the processing system, I can take the noise level down to like S5 and dig out very weak signals. I worked a couple of VX stations, checked in that nobody else could hear them. If the noise level was too high in there, we had these VX stations. It just happened that the conditions were that they were only coming in here like S4, 5 at the most, S3, and I was able to receive them. So that method, like you're talking about, is a very good method, but you got to take it one step further, like I say, and add a Q multiplier to it. The Q multiplier really brings up the dynamic range, and that's really because when you process it through, you know, the either FET up amplifiers, the signal really may be degraded, even though it may be improved, but it's a lot of degrade. It's degraded in strength, Dick. So that's the way I restore it, more or less. And I find that at most times now, I got to back off the RF gain on the receiver, even with turning it down on the unit. But I find I back off then the RF gain on the receiver. So, you know, I ride the RF gain on the receiver, which also helps to reduce the noise level, which is usually ferocious on 75 meters in any urban area, Dick, over.
Yeah, that receiver, he's backing off the RF gain on. If I know him, it's a Collins receiver. And that thing is strong like bull. You don't overload a Collins. Okay. Hey, Barry, when you start using that MFJ, what is it now, 1026 or 1126? I forgot the model number you've got. I think it's 1026. Sounds like a fun circuit. What was that originally intended to do, Barry?
I'm not sure. It's called a noise canceller, so I think originally they wanted to be able to phase the antennas to use it as a kind of a blanker kind of circuit, you know, where you would be able to get rid of static and things like that. But they did mention that they think it's also good for eliminating offending signals because of that very fact that both signals will not arrive at the same antenna exactly the same. In other words, one guy is going to be in one phase and the other guy is going to be some different phase when he reaches your antenna. So when you try to tweak it like this, you'll get rid of one, but it shouldn't affect the other one too much, and that's why they sell it. I've never used it. I got it from Richie. He loaned it to me. I was going to use it, and now I think I'm going to try it.
Okay, 2MLB.
Good luck, and let us know how that works out. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, I had a 1026 here for a while. I had you may remember the ANC so-called noise cancelers or noise blankers. What they did was just that. You had a receiving antenna, and then the antenna that you wanted to signal at, and then the device changed the phase internally. And I was using it when 6 meters was hot. I think I might have mentioned that in order to try and cancel the same noise as was bothering me, I actually would switch the blanking device to my 10-meter antenna and just use that as the input to the noise blanker, because number one, it was rotating on the same power, so it would be facing the same direction as the 6-meter antenna, and chances are pick up the same signal. But I think for all practical purposes now, I heard that the 1026, I don't want to use these words, but you know, it was a carbon copy or an improvement, or call it what you will, of the ANC device.
Okay, good to know. Looking forward to when you guys come back and tell us what you find out. KB2URZ, your signal was a little bit weak last time, but let's give it a go. Start off with your name, sir, and then your question. KB2URZ, K2RIW, my name is Dick. Okay, maybe Mr. URZ got called away. Did I forget anybody that signed up to our list tonight? If so, speak now, K2RIW.
Yeah, I just might want to comment that one night we really should get into the subject of noise blankers. That's one that I spent a lot of time in several years when I was on Moonbound trying to get rid of noise. And Frank, I understand what you're saying. One of the problems you run into the way you were doing it, using the signal on 10 meters to blank noise on 6 meters, is a phase problem. In fact, even if you're on the same band, if you're just on a slightly different frequency, you're going to have a phase problem. Most of these blankers never really address the phase problem very much, and how you could move the phase back and forth to get these static pulses in phase with each other again, or out of phase, whichever you wish. But this particular unit has a pretty fancy phase control on it, and they say that you can, by throwing a switch, you can move the phase 360 degrees. So that should make this a lot easier.
Okay, Wilder comments. Absolutely right. Some of the guys that were going a step further actually put a 6-meter antenna on the tower as well, so that the blanker would have, you know, an identical antenna, although it was separated from the other one, so there still would have been a little phase difference.
Yeah, when you're listening to noise on another band, the noise pulse could be longer, it could be shorter, there could be other noise pulses added that you don't hear on the other frequency. There's just so many variables.
K2KY comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, Mel recognized, and I've got a question after that. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, the reason that a lot of people do not have the success with that noise quasher, I have built this originally from the original article, the guys who designed it originally. And I built it, and I shook my head a little bit, because what I was using at that time, I used it, I figured, oh, I'll pick up local noise. I just figured I'll use a whip antenna and in a shack and feed it in there and, hook it up just in a simple conventional style. I found now with the receiving loops that I'm using, I have two receiving loops, remember. I take my main, or whichever receiving loop I decide that is going to be the so-called one to receive the signal. I aim that at the signal. And then I take the other one that's for picking up the noise, and I peak the noise. And it seldom is that the noise and the receive signal are exactly in line. It's always off this way or that way a little bit. But I found when I peak individually, the signal that I'm receiving and the noise separate with the loop, and then put it through that phase. The phase, first of all, the phase adjustment comes alive. Otherwise, it's yes, no. But when I've got those two signals, I just say peak. See the signals you want to hear, the noise signals you want to get rid of, and then put it through that and adjust that phasing. You'll see, Vic, some real action on it, over.
That makes some sense. So get the greatest discrimination on the two individual antennas to begin with. One's going to be the noise receiver, peak it up on the noise. One's going to be the receiver for the signal, peak it up on the signal. Then do the combination. And it is my guess, and here's my question to you, Barry, that as you move the frequency that you monitor for the noise signal closer and closer in frequency to the signal you want to listen to, it is my guess that the noise gets canceled better and better up to the point where the skirts of the filter on the receiver system listening to noise starts listening to signal. Then I think you start getting a degraded performance. And I guess you'd like to try both with the noise receiver a little bit on the high side or a little bit on the low side. But if it's on the same band, close in frequency, I'd like to believe there's close correlation in the noise pulses, and therefore the degree of cancellation improves. I wonder if you've seen anything like that, Barry. N2MB, K2RW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that's exactly what I used to run into. That's why I always would blank with noise almost exactly on frequency, as you say. Just outside the filter, a little outside the filter, I would use that noise. However, what I'm trying to do here is not eliminate noise. My noise blanker is working pretty good. What I'm trying to do is eliminate signal. And we have, you know, I'm listening to a guy from Europe, and I have other stations, perhaps, maybe static. It could be static, or it could be stations from the United States. I'm trying to null them out. So what I want to do is get them, and that works, because the signal coming from Europe is never going to be exactly the same as the signal coming from the United States. So my trying to phase out the guy from the United States should have very little effect on a guy from Europe. That's what I'm trying to do.
Comment?
Go ahead.
Yeah, Barry, I don't have the 1026 anymore, but I do have the manual. Do you have the manual? Because I'd be glad to send you this copy.
I don't believe I have the manual. That's very nice. Okay. I think I can get the manual. I think MFJ was kind enough that you can get it off the internet, so I don't think that's gonna be a problem, but I appreciate that.
Oh. Now Dick, I have one more comment to take to see why.
Okay, Frank, repeat your comment and then pass it over to Mel.
Oh, I'm sorry, I just said that if you need it, I'd be glad to mail you the manual. That's all, just let me know.
Hey, thank you, Frank. I duly appreciate that, and I have jotted that down. You do have it. If I run into a problem, thank you very much, and I will call you on that.
Fine.
You got it, Mel.
Okay, about 2 weeks ago, one night I was on the air looking for my friend in Pennsylvania, and the noise coming from the way the loop was set was ferocious. I could hear the static, tremendous burst. And he didn't get on because he said there was a lot of flashing in the sky, so he just did not get on. So I was just sitting, and glancing at the scope. Usually I just glance at the pan scope. And I saw a signal pop up a little lower in frequency, so I turned the receiver to him, and it was a guy calling CQ from down South Carolina. So I turned the receiving loop, and I peaked him up and adjusted it. Dick, when I adjusted it now south, because my friend in Pennsylvania is almost due west, I now swung the loop around to the south. The receiving loop peaked up everything. Do you know, I did not hear that static discharge that from the lightning storm that they were having over in the, Ohio, Pennsylvania area. I did not hear that with the loop. So it shows you how much it could really, null the noise by just adjusting it correctly, and I was amazed that I could, all of a sudden the noise was gone. I mean, I never had that, with 75, 80 meters, usually, when that's any lightning anywhere in the United States during the warm, as we get to the warm weather, makes almost 75 unusable, especially during the summer months, Dick. But I was amazed that I did not hear it when I turned the loop down south over.
Now, what you guys are doing on HF is something that's been done for lots and lots of years on master antenna TV systems that were being used for cable TV. In the old days, cable TV wasn't being relayed by satellite and fiber. A station would be set up on a high hill somewhere, and they would aim a specific antenna at each one of the broadcast centers they wanted to pick up the signal from and put it onto their cable to distribute to their community down in the valley. Well, they invented something called a co-channel interference setup. What they would literally do is put one Yagi aimed at the desired station, another Yagi was aimed at the undesired station that was on the exact same frequency, and maybe it was another 300 miles away, and so when they do the right combination of those two Yagis, the Yagi aimed at the desired station, the side lobes of it are weakly picking up the undesired station. Well, the undesired station to desired station ratio on television better be 45 or 50 dB. If you got an undesired signal on a television picture that's 40 dB weaker, it gives you weak herringbones in the picture, and you watch the herringbones crawl around as the weaker station is changing its programming material. So the human eye is very critical of interference. You'd like a 47 dB of signal-to-noise ratio in order to declare it snow-free. And so you can do it with this technique of aiming one Yagi at each of the stations and doing the right combination to cancel. And I'll bet you they got cancellations at times of at least 30 decibels. And that would make a picture that was kind of uncomfortable suddenly turn into high fidelity. So
they also have to adjust the amplitude of the offending signal, too, because they want it to be about what it is in the real receive antenna.
You're exactly right. Go ahead, Deb. I bet you've been involved in some of this stuff, Eric, in the old days. Is that true?
Well, if you remember, in beyond your backyard, there used to be 390-foot phone poles with a lot of antennas on them, and used to be on top of that a bit. And actually, what you're saying is mostly correct, but there were a couple of other tricks that we did. And one of the things that the FCC had set up, not the FCC, but the NTSC committee, is that you'll notice that there are stations, their carriers are offset from being on channel plus 25 kilohertz, minus 25 kilohertz, plus 10 kilohertz, minus 10 kilohertz, and that gave us a way to identify where the offending signal was. Some of the head-end equipment would actually take a Yagi that was pointed in the direction of a seriously offending co-channel signal, and it would subtract that in the head-end amplifier. But the beats that you'd get from the offset would also have to be compensated.
So what did you guys do to offset the beats? I'm beginning to think you had to convert the two signals down to a common IF and offset those IFs by 10 KC or 25 KC to get rid of the beat. Is that true?
Actually, when you had what they called a head-end processor, in those days you had they actually did all the processing at IF. The IFs were standard, 47, 45 megahertz, and that was also used for matrix switching so that they could put, you know, say, channel 12 on, channel 21 on channel 12, or, you know, change the actual channel assignments in those days. They also had a matrix switcher that was driven by a clock, so they did a lot of stuff that way. But the real trick was, if you knew what direction the co-channel was coming from, you generally built a Yagi which had real tiny side lobes. And if you remember, that on that wooden setup up there, like for channel 2, there were actually four Yagis, because you get strong co-channel from Boston and strong co-channel from Philadelphia.
I seem to remember for a while you had two telephone poles side by side with cross pieces of something like 2x6 between them, and lots of things mounted on that. And you're the guy that was climbing those tolls on Mr. Nishimura's setup. Is that what's going on here, Eric?
Yeah, James Y. Nishimura. I could tell you stories about him. Actually, he was originally with the Chinaman, who had the first cable TV system in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And they both had work for Gerald, so. That's a long story. It's actually three poles. It was a triangle.
And chunks of wood between them and all kinds of antennas mounted up there. Were you the guy that was doing some of the pole work, or was it the other man that worked with you guys?
No, I fixed the head end stuff, and occasionally I had to go up there. There were no steps on those poles. You had a few strictly gaps in the belt, and those poles were so big you couldn't even put your arms around them.
I do remember that. Very sturdy. Quite an arrangement. And he had sort of a trailer mounted up on cinder blocks was the actual enclosure that all this stuff was contained in. And I believe on Saturday afternoons he would hire somebody to come and play a video cassette recorder in order to put certain movies onto the cable channel. Is that true?
Yeah, that didn't last very long. That was very early on. There were some. He set up his own movie service at his at the office. The office started out being in East Northport, and then it moved down to Step Out Place in Huntington. And we put a studio together there and a whole bunch of stuff. And then he bought services from the Comac system, which was United Artists. We actually had microwaves that went between them. And then, of course, we had this AM microwave system that would get all the, you know, it would be like a sort of like a cable system via microwave, where all the various different companies, and this was before Cablevision, before Charlie Dolan, where they would share a distant signal. So that's kind of how they distributed stuff before all the satellites.
Boy, that was some fancy electronics in those days. That total system, total investment, we're talking about megabucks here to install all those cables on all those towers, all those drops to all those houses. Rather large investment in hardware to make all that work. Is that true, Eric?
Oh, I would say it was a rather large investment for the day. Don't forget the dollar was worth quite different than it is today. But, you know, you don't think about it, but today I think it costs something like 15 or 20,000. No, it's probably more than that now. It used to cost about between $5,000 and $7,000 a mile to put cable up and amplifiers. What people don't realize that, you know, every 1,500 feet there's another amplifier. Why? Because you just went through 20 dB of cable.
Wow. 1,500 feet per amplifier, does that mean on average 4 amplifiers per mile or a little bit less?
That's correct. And if you wanted to keep the cost modulation down and all the really awful artifacts in an analog cable system, we did two things. We tilted the high band and the low band. The other thing that we did is you kind of restricted any trunk line from not having more than, say, 25 or 30 amplifiers. But at the end of that line, the noise figure is pretty bad.
Was there a high-frequency and a low-frequency pilot tone, and the tilting device inside those amplifiers would adjust itself for a hot day versus a cold day, so as to try to keep those pilot tones equal in amplitude at all those amplifiers downrange? Because if you run out of dynamic range on any of those amplifiers in the string for the multiple miles you're going through, you can't get it back again. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's correct. There was a low-frequency pilot tone and a high-frequency pilot tone. What was it, 136 megahertz? And there was another one at, I think it was in between, I don't remember now. Yeah, it's in between 7 and 8. Or was it 16? No, it's in between 6 and 7. It was just below channel 7. Yeah, that's where it was. So that made it about 170 megahertz. The later version of the amplifiers had thermistor compensated equalizers in them, and really didn't need the pilot tones. As the technology got better, that sort of went away.
And each of these amplifiers had to be very high dynamic range devices, because they're carrying a zillion channels all at once, and so the amplifier, if it has the slightest bit of nonlinearity, once it starts mixing those multiple signals together, and therefore you get cross-modulation. So I'm guessing each of your amplifiers are quite a number of watts of peak envelope power, even though each of your signals are in the milliwatt region. Is that approximately true?
Oh, you can think of it that way. The maximum output of the trunk line amplifiers was plus 40 dBmV. And not dBm, dBmV. Each amplifier typically had a gain of 20 dB, so you can figure it out from that.
Okay, 1 microvolt, if a dBm with reference to a microvolt is minus 107, 40 dB above that is still a pretty weak signal. Maybe it's dB above a millivolt, not a microvolt. Is that true? Oh, dB above.
That's correct. 0 dBmV was a millivolt, right? I could be wrong about that. Now my brain isn't working, but yeah. No, 60 dBmV is a volt. That's right, 60 dBmV was a volt.
So 40 dB above dB, 0 dBmV is minus 20 dB with reference to a volt. Still a pretty potent signal on a 70 ohm line. And I guess each drop was around 0 dBmV, was it not?
Yeah, well, the way the cable systems work, you have trunk line amplifiers, and then there are directional couplers at the output of the trunk line amplifiers, actually in the cases themselves, which would go into the subscriber drop. Those, in turn, went into what they called line extender amplifiers. Those things had gains of 40 dB, 40 dB, and they were smaller and nastier, but you only had one or two and, you know, and cascade with each other. You didn't cascade those things because you just wreaked havoc with the entire bandpass.
The actual directional coupler that samples the signal on the line for the consumer drop, was that adjustable in coupling coefficient, or did you select a model A, model B, or model C, depending on how far upline the guy was? So was that directional coupler in some way adjustable, and how strong the signal was going to get to the consumer? Back to you, Eric.
In the trunk line amplifiers, there are little plug-ins that are for fixed values. And actually, at the subscriber drop, I mean, it's all simple math. You start off with, say, plus 40 dB of signal. You go through X number of feet of cable, you subtract the loss of that. You figure that you want your subscriber to be at the house, inside, somewhere between 0 and plus 5 dBmV or plus 10 dBmV max. So you had directional couplers, which were 3 dB, which were really splitters, 6 dB, 7 dB, 10, 15 or 16, that's a long time, bitch. I don't remember the exact values, but yeah, you selected from any number of fixed values, and of course it was all worked out beforehand so that the guy going out there building the system knew what to put in.
Were you ever plagued by the man who installed the connectors on the end of the hard line doing less than an ideal job, so you had to go back later and eliminate leakage by reinstalling connectors? Did that ever happen, Eric, K2RIW?
Yeah, K2RIW, K2J. Well, I was 18 years old, and I think I must have replaced, like, oh, my time wasn't for that man, which is way too long. I don't know, I must have replaced maybe 500 or 600 of those stinking miserable connectors. And it's not just how usually replace them, because what I usually put the rip loops on them, you don't have much room for mistakes, so we used to have these little extender pieces that would screw into the trunk line there, and then put the actual connector on, so you had to cut it back a little bit, you know. A lot of people never made good ground, so people would be not subscribing to cable and getting ghosts like you couldn't believe, and they could never figure out where it was coming from.
Understand. Now, the early brands of connectors, I think, didn't have a real good collet mechanism, which clamped the cable on the inside of the outer conductor, as well as squeezing down with the collet mechanism on the outside. There was a ferrule that went on the inside on the early ones. So, with pole vibration of the wind and whatever, these connectors would work themselves loose. So, I do remember seeing some of the very early connectors, which I think were of an inferior design, and then they had to be replaced with the better connectors downrange. Nixa Pruzan, I think, was one of the companies that was making a